Welcome to Rates and Barrels. It is Wednesday, December 16th. At least it probably is by the time you're listening to this podcast. We are recording a little bit earlier than that, recording midday on Tuesday the 15th. Derek Van Riper here with Eno Saris, as we expected. By recording shows on consecutive days, the always slow MLB offseason offered us nothing new in terms of interesting topics that are based on signings and trades and activity, but fortunately, we're adept at entertaining ourselves. Eno's got a great piece coming up later this week. We'll talk about some of the process behind that. He's looking at page views on Fangraphs against production, trying to find some insights into the minds of the common fantasy owner. It's one way I'm looking at this anyway. I think it's a pretty fascinating piece, really cool idea, and some awesome visualizations in that piece as well. Going to get to a few more free agents, try to predict where they're going to go. We started that up on our last episode, so if you listen to this one and say, why didn't you talk about George Springer? Well, we talked about him on the last one, so you can go back and listen to that. Eno, how's it going for you on this Tuesday?
It's going good. The reason we're doing this early is the worst of all possible reasons. It's called Housemageddon, and what it is the dogs are getting snipped.
Oh, that's happening too? You described your problem yesterday as two children in the house also on Zoom with you and your wife, and that's chaos in and of itself, but the animals are getting fixed.
That's how you get to full Housemageddon. And I don't think we have not yet done a good job of explaining to the children that the dogs will have cones and will not really want to hang out. And the kids are very hands-on with these pups, so they're not going to be super excited about that. And I've got them because my wife is going to take the dogs to do the deed. Mm. So your prayers in this time of need. otherwise, you know, there's also bad news. The one piece of news that I did see this morning was bad news, which is that the players and the MLB ownership are at an impasse or currently negotiating, but are not super excited about the same things. And one of that we saw that last year when they got into an argument about how many games they should play. You saw that the owners were sort of arguing for fewer games, perhaps to cut their losses to some extent. And the players were asking for more games, and that has repeated. The players are out there sort of, maybe not as a monolith, but are generally saying, let's have a full season. We've proved that we can play with different protocols in place, and we should start the season with or without fans and welcome the fans in when that becomes feasible. I think that's a defensible stance, especially since they're the ones risking anything when it comes to, they're the most at risk in terms of they're the ones in the clubhouse, which seems like the riskiest situation in baseball. And, they want to play. So it's a Bob Nightingale report. It may just be a couple people he's talking to, so he may not. Anytime you do a report like that, who knows if he has the pulse of everybody. But he talked to a few owners and he talked to a few players, and that seems to be what that's probably also heating it's impeding a chance for us to know if there's if there's a DH in the league and what the roster sizes will be and stuff that. Fantasy fans want to know about.
Right. And I think if the owners still want to try and play a slightly reduced or significantly reduced season, that would probably mean in some cases the season length determines a team's interest in a particular player. So that's holding up free agency, holding up trade movement. Get out of your own way, MLB. There's more things to be optimistic about than pessimistic about in general, right? Vaccines have been rolled out this week. We're starting to see the first people being treated with those, and that's a step in the right direction, a huge step in the right direction, and it's only December 15th, right? So to sit here today and pretend like the season couldn't possibly start on time when the players just played without the vaccine and learned all the new protocols, and you could still use a lot of those protocols, carry them over, right? Keep people as safe as possible. I think the owners are going to end up looking very bad in this if they try to shorten the upcoming season based on where things stand right now. And it's just the last thing the game needs, another fight over something that is, frankly, just gross.
It's in baseball's best interest with regards to other sports, too, because we're seeing that basketball is going to start, you know? And since basketball's starting late, it's going to run into the beginning of baseball season. And if they manage to have a representative normal season where baseball is dragging its heels with another labor dispute, there is a pantheon of sport. Like, there is choice when it comes to sports. Like, I have largely gotten rid of football in my life. I used to pretty much watch football on Sundays. I don't care anymore. And I don't know. There's a lot of reasons for that. And we don't need to necessarily get into that, but that's what happens when certain things come out about a sport, or there's certain choices that are made, or even labor choices, or, you know, there's all sorts of reasons. Maybe you decide that there's too many three-pointers in basketball and you can't watch it anymore. You know, like there's all these things that make people decide, and they do decide. And we saw that when there was labor strife in 1994, viewership was down. And I think to some extent, Bud Selig looked the other way on the steroid era in order to allow that to curry more fandom and like bring baseball back. And so that becomes like this weird chickens coming home to roost sort of situation later. But hey, Bud Selig's not complaining. He's in the Hall of Fame.
Yes, he is. And it's a strange relationship as a Brewers fan with Bud Selig, because he's often credited with keeping professional baseball in Milwaukee, right? If a different owner had picked up the Brewers prior to the construction of Miller Park, that team may have been relocated. Small enough media market. Teams were moving in that era, easily could have seen the Brewers on the road in the late 90s. So I have to look at Bud Selig, guy who owned the Brewers, a little bit differently than Bud Selig, the guy who ended the All-Star game in a tie, or Bud Selig, all the other commission. You know, you can go on and on and on, but we don't have to make this an anti-Selig pod. That's going even darker than we need to. But the concerns about the season
I'm in
length are valid.
So that's why.
Yeah, right. It feels like the walls are closing in, because in some ways they are for you. But you gave me some insight into the piece that you are going to have coming out later this week, and I want to start with that on this episode, because you're taking a look at player popularity, and by that, it's FanGraphs page views, and you're looking at that against projected WAR. So you're going to see some players who are very good based on WAR and highly searched, but you're also going to see some players who are very good based on WAR and who are not highly searched, and you have the whole gamut there within the chart. But I'm just going to step back for a second. What led you to take a look at this? Because it's a really interesting data set to break down.
Twitter, man. Twitter, you know, people ask me what I do when there's no baseball season on. I stare at Twitter.
Seems healthy.
No, it's definitely not healthy. But I wish that I could tell you who did the tweet, but somebody looked at basketball players against basketball reference hits and made some sort of analysis. I didn't even read the analysis. I just said, oh, that's intriguing. I'd like to do that for baseball. And so I got an insight into the hits on a player's page over the last calendar year, and it's kind of fun, for example, to see that Mike Trout had twice the hits of the second place player in baseball, which is Mookie Betts, and also is projected for 2.5 more wins than Mookie Betts and projected for the most wins in baseball. But if you just look at projected wins above replacement and you put that up against their hits, you can actually predict popularity. You can predict almost half of the variance in popularity. So that's pretty good. Like, you only have one thing and it's projected quality. But already you can say, like, well why not? Like, what would change... you know, why would somebody be more or less popular than how good they are? You'd think, like, this is a meritocracy, right? Well, let's look at this. The fourth best production in terms of projected war by Steamer is by Alex Bregman next year. And the two players around him got twice the hits. So Jake DeGrom, Alex Bregman, Juan Soto, that's the group. And DeGrom and Soto got twice the hits each as Bregman did. So, you know, I think that that's has to do with things that are just more complicated and not going to show up on a graph. You know, the Astros are not popular right now. You know, people are not excited about the Astros nationally. Bregman seems to be at the kind of one of the main people in the cheating scandal. You know, but there are other players that don't fit that as well. Sometimes it's you know, market size. Matt Chapman is projected to be the 15th best player in baseball next year by Steamer. And ahead of him is Garrett Cole, who gets nearly twice the hits. You got the sort of Yankees versus A's thing right there on display. Then I don't know what to do with this one. This is kind of interesting. Rafael Devers is the 22nd best player, tied with Yu Darvish in terms of projected WAR. Yu Darvish got more than twice the hits he got. Devers is a good young player. There's some oscillation in his talent, so you might want to go to look at his page to see if he's, you know, what Devers are going to get next year. But maybe the Red Sox Nation is just so, you know, like, not excited right now. I don't know. Maybe they feel like not ready for this rebuild. Maybe you're just not getting a lot of the fan base on Fangraphs right now because they feel like this might be a long rebuild. But as I've said, you know, just on the last show, I'm not sure that this is going to be a long rebuild. So that one kind of sticks out. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways that we could look at it. I found it pretty interesting to look at it. I think for fantasy, it's those players become possible values.
Right. So I think one thing that could drive up players' searches or page views, however you want to describe it. If I say hits, people are going to think I mean like hits on the field.
Yeah, right.
Would be being kind of a global star, right? Like you see Yu Darvish, you see Shohei Ohtani, and you see Hyunjin Ryu getting a lot more page views than other players who are similarly productive. And I just wonder if that kind of sheds some light on just how global their reach is.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, Ohtani's right there. Like, Ohtani was one of the most popular ones, and he's projected for a win and a half. So he really sticks out. He has five times the views of Rowdy Tellez, who's projected for 1.6 wins. But instructive is also that Kyle Lewis is right behind Shohei Ohtani in projected Steamer outcome, but almost has the same amount of hits. So there is something also about like youth and excitement and untested nature and sort of I'm going to go on this page and decide if I think Kyle Lewis can repeat, you know, his production as a Rookie of the Year candidate. And so I found it kind of interesting to go look at the prospects that made this list. I had the top 500 prospects by hits. The prospects that I've got here are in order. So this is a kind of a consensus prospects list. I mean, it's probably skewed by people who read the Fangraphs prospect list. But they don't line. It doesn't line up with, you know, what you might expect the Fangraphs prospect list to look like. But there are like people who were traded on it, and you know, just sort of interesting players that maybe some debuts on here. So like number one is Wander Franco. Okay, you're good. You got a good list so far. Two is Dylan Carlson. Three is Joe Adele. So there you've got the like debuted and now, and I want to see how bad it was and see if there's a heel for the future. Then next comes Mackenzie Gore, Jeter Downs. So maybe Red Sox Nation is just, you know, already on board of this rebuild and they're just looking at Jeter Downs and Alex Verdugo and Tristan Casas pages, right? So Jeter Downs is there ahead of Nick Madrigal. Then there's Nate Pearson. And then Jared Kelenich and Julio Rodriguez come in 8 and 9. And Andrew Vaughn rounds it out at 10. I put a top 20 in there. Taylor Trammell's on there. He got traded. Drew Waters is in there. He was rumored to be traded. So I thought it was an interesting way to look at prospects too. Although, to me, Kelenich and Rodriguez are probably the two most exciting prospects, not named Wander Franco. And to see them at 9 and 10 was, I didn't, or 8 and 9, I didn't quite know what to make of that. Maybe they're not moving teams and they're close enough that it's, you know, you've made a decision on them. You don't need to go to their Fangraphs page. You're like, I like them. I don't know.
Yeah, now we're two off seasons removed from the Kelenich trade that, you know, sent him to Seattle. So interest has maybe quieted a little bit on that front. I think the most interesting group of players so far, at least as I've started digging into the chart that you put together, are the young players who come in well under expectations for how often they're searched or pulled up. And an example would be Alec Bohm.
Yeah, why?
He comes in as a really well-projected player people don't seem to be that interested in. And Ke'Bryan Hayes is the other guy that's kind of in a similar part of the chart. With Hayes, I'm actually surprised more people aren't looking for him. I realize he's a Pirate, and Pirates are not popular, and that would obviously be a negative weight on any player. Be a Pirate, and you'll come in a lot lower than you probably should. I would expect that this winter, there's been a ton of people digging into Ke'Bryan Hayes and just trying to figure out what to do with a guy that only had 95 plate appearances, but tore the cover off the ball for those 95 plate appearances. I mean, Ke'Bryan Hayes hit 376 with a 442 OBP, hit 5 home runs. We knew all along as a prospect he was going to be a plus defender at third base. That was always going to pave his way to the big leagues, and you know how much power he developed on top of an above average hit tool was going to shape just how much we liked him from a fantasy perspective. So I wonder if those are buying opportunities in long-term leagues relative to the quality of those players. Not that people are going to give you Ke'Bryan Hayes for less than they should, but perhaps that they are not valuing him correctly and they would be more willing to move him than they ought to be in a fair trade.
Yeah, I have to wonder if the market is part of that. It does make you think of, like, you know, Lauer Michaels, rest in peace. He always had a ton of A's on his team. He got to see them. He kind of scouted them. But also, in terms of market, the A's were just not driving the same kind of interest. And there was often sort of like a utility dude, Chad Pinder type, that in an AL only was just super useful that he could get for a dollar or two. And that was kind of like the Lauer Michaels special when it came to AL labor. But, you know, it also at the top of the list, there are established players that are uninteresting to people for some reason. And that's Alex Bregman, but he has more of like sort of an Astros based explanation. There are some other guys that I think maybe market based like Ke'Bryan Hayes were, you know, like, okay, for example, Anthony Rendon, almost a third of the hits of Mookie Betts and projected for only 0.2 wins less.
Yeah, an old boring star.
Yes, that's what I think the list I'm about to make is. I'm just scanning here for differences here. Yasmani Grandal, Devers is on this list. Xander Bogaerts is on this list. Trea Turner, is underperforming. What you'd expect, Steven Strasburg, Paul DeJong, Alec Baum thing. Let me see if I got any real negative ones here. Nick Madrigal, that's just weird. I think some of the prospects may have had two pages. Debuts might have been affected by that. But let me find some ones that were under the curve. I've made a best fit line, and you can kind of see some that were under the curve. One thing that showed that messed with my best fit line was like Babe Ruth, who is like 125 years old if he were still alive. So the age thing, I had to cut off the age thing for him. And like Babe Ruth, Barry Bonds, Ken Griffey Jr., they're still top 500 in hits, even though they're not going to give you any value next year. But you know, there's definitely a list of boring guys that don't do as well as you'd expect. Patrick Corbin is on that list. I don't know. I think that there's, you know, there's always an opportunity, you know, in a, especially like a, I think of like Paul DeJong, you know, like that guy's going to be good. He's going to be fine. He's going to be useful in most leagues. He could be one. He could be I'm not going to bid on all these shortstop strategy where you end up getting a ton of great players and you get Paul DeJong in the final rounds and just slot him in. That type of player. They definitely stick out in this analysis.
I put this out as a tweet maybe a week or so ago because I was really surprised. I think it was really more about the first player of the two, but I had player A since the start of 2019. These guys are both shortstops. Player A / 258, 293, 481, 37 homers, 14 steals, over 100 runs, over 100 RBIs. ADP in early drafts is around pick 75. This is since the start of 2019. Mm-hmm. Player B, 237, 319, 424, but 33 home runs. It's almost the same number, four less. 10 steals, four less. 114 runs, only two less than the other player, and 103 RBIs, so only six less than the other player. And the early ADP on player B is just outside the top 200. I mean, you're talking about 20 points in batting average and pretty much nothing else separating those players. That doesn't seem like, if there aren't job security concerns with the cheaper player, that player B looks a little undervalued, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Even Paul DeJong.
Even if there's like, you know, stolen bases or, you know, certain things that, you know, that can explain some of it on the field, like the gap is not as large as that ADP suggests it should be.
Right, so maybe player B is almost appropriately priced, but player A at pick 75 does not seem like a good value. Who do you think player A is?
Well, I know who it is.
No, you know who it is. You saw the tweet.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so the player A is Javi Baez, which it made me ill because I saw this after I put Javi Baez on my keeper league team. I picked him up in the XFL auction last weekend, dug in a little more and said, Paul DeJong for $15 less in the auction might have been the way to go on that one and, you know, spend the extra money somewhere else for an upgrade. It doesn't necessarily mean that DeJong is way underpriced. It could mean that Baez is overpriced, but I do think you don't necessarily in your mind think of DeJong as a reasonable comp for Baez. That's the broader point here. And sometimes that is, it's perception, right? Paul DeJong does kind of have a boring player vibe to him. I don't know why. That's the way our minds can sort of destroy us sometimes in the analysis, and I think that does happen with perceptions of certain teams. Oh, the Pirates can't score runs, so Ryan Hayes is going to lag in runs and RBIs. Well, it's like, well, maybe you're overestimating how much he's going to lag. Like, maybe he's going to lag a little, but he's priced as though he's going to lag a lot in those categories.
I should have tried batting average in there. I did try some components. Home runs move the needle the most outside of WAR. Innings pitched was the big one for pitchers. I just think that means that you're more likely to visit a player page that's healthy in pitching. I don't know. But I have some more boarding names for you. Germán Márquez, Salvador Perez, Christian Vázquez, Aaron Hicks, Nathan Eovaldi. Let's see here, Justin Turner, Jorge Polanco, Heimer Candelario, a little bit surprising, Kyle Gibson. There's definitely a boring player type that you can take advantage of in fantasy.
I'm surprised Edilberto Mondesi isn't at least on the line. He's below the line. He's right around a three-win player,
yeah,
and
I
he's
wonder
below.
If there's some market factors there. Could be.
Yeah. Tiny market, I think, is probably the most likely explanation there, because we know the fantasy community is all over Edilberto Mondesi's Fangraphs page.
Yeah. Like, I think, and Sean Murphy, I think, is my pick to click for catcher next year. I mean, I had him as my AL labor catcher last year, and I think he's really underrated, and he got 2,000 fewer views than Edilberto Mondesi. So, there could be sort of a market factor there. But yeah, I had some fun with it. There's a little bit more coming. You know, comparing it to jersey sales, comparing hitters to pitchers, which position was... how about this? Could you guess which position was the least popular?
I would guess first base.
And you would be wrong.
Catcher.
Nope.
It's not first base or catcher?
No. Catcher is second worst.
Relievers?
Oh, that's not broken out. I just have a pitcher.
Okay.
But it is the outfield.
That's odd. I can't think of a real reason for that. Older,
yeah, I can see shortstop
players,
is number one, right? That makes sense.
Yeah.
Shortstop is number one. That's why you put your most athletic young guy, you know, it's shortstop's the most exciting position. Second is third base. Then comes first base. So those are the sluggers. But, you know, you have sluggers in the outfield. You know what? I don't understand it. I don't understand it. Maybe there's three of them, so you know you don't latch on. But like some of the biggest names in baseball are outfielders, and they should be giving them hits there. So just the thing that happened.
Yeah, that one doesn't make any sense to me. But
yeah, some of these stuff you're just like, but you know, popularity is kind of funny like that. It's just like you know, you can try to kind of get at it a certain way, there's always going to be someone you're like, but. Why is Nick Castellanos super popular?
Couldn't tell you. Could not give you a good reason why he would be a popular player. But yeah, cool thing that's coming out. Definitely check out the piece once it is available. Let's talk about some more free agents. That was a big theme on yesterday's show, and we leaned a little more toward the top hitters yesterday. We'll have both hitters and pitchers, of course, on today's show. And we talked about Trevor Bauer sort of briefly. We'll kind of close the book on him. If you're making the final call on where Bauer ends up today, where is he signing?
I still stick with the Angels, man. I think they got the biggest need. They're gonna come up with a number. I kind of am going away from the one-year thing, though. I had 1 year and $36.5 million, and you know why?
Because it would top Garrett Cole.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's crazy, isn't it?
And like the only thing that would be more Bauer if it was like 36.69420.
Oh yeah, that's what, no matter what the final main dollar amount is, it's ending in 0.69420. It'd be impossible for it not to. Like that has been the plan all along, regardless of how long the deal is. I think you're probably right, though. I mean, I think it's just going to be harder in this environment to get a team to pony up that AAV. Pre-pandemic,
yeah, like
I think that was more possible. But we know, we talked about the Red Sox yesterday. They don't want to get anywhere near the luxury tax threshold. A lot of other teams that could be interested in Bauer are going to get really close to that number if they end up piling all the money into a big one-year deal.
And that would be their one acquisition for a lot of teams. You know, that's just not appealing. They want to look like they're doing a lot of work. Also, you think about this. Most teams now are speaking. There was a comment that I think Andy Martino made. In that was like put on TV and people lampooned it, and he said something about, you know, it's not about winning the World Series this year, it's about creating good process and having a team that could win it any given year and stuff like that. And that's and it was lampooned because people say, well, if it's not about winning the World Series, what is it about? And I understand that perspective, but you also, from the perspective of a front office person, understand that you'd rather have a team that sort of is in it every year, and you can kind of just keep that train plugging along, and you plug in guys and plug out guys. And because there's a fair amount of noise, I think, in any given postseason, and it's not obvious noise where like, oh my God, that play could have gone either way. It's like, look what happened to the Padres this year. In one universe, the Padres could have won it all this year. In the universe where Clevinger comes over and is super healthy and dominates, and Denilson Lamet is healthy and dominates, like that team, you know, with those two players, that could have made a difference. So I think injury is the big source of chaos and noise. And so you build a team that could compete if they don't get any injuries. And if they get the bad injuries, you sell around the edges and you come back and do it again the next year. That's, I think, what the process is. And from having grown up in Atlanta, I can't fault it that much, because it was fun to be in the postseason every year. And yes, as it started to kind of grate on you that they hadn't won it all, they finally did win it all. And I think it was more of a ride to kind of, you know, have a good team every year than it would be to be a fan of the Marlins. And obviously fandom reflects that. Consistent winning gets people in the seats. So I think consistent winning makes sense. And this is why it's a long preamble to why it matters for Trevor Bauer. I don't think teams really want to sign a guy for 1 year. I mean, they will if they think it's Marcell Ozuna, and like, if he's good, great. If he's mediocre, fine. I'm not tagged in for the whole thing, but they'd rather have somebody like Bauer locked in, I think, for 5 years. So they can say, this is now part of our window. You know, he's going to make us better for 5 years.
Well, they could meet in the middle by offering an opt-out after 2 years or after 3 years, right? If Bauer wants that flexibility to go out and make more money, and if he's unhappy with the team he chooses because they don't put enough competitive pieces around him, he wants to bail out, that's fine. Like, that's becoming more common. I think that's the happy medium, right? And I think the other thing you have to consider, I know this is not always important to the individual players themselves, but how does this decision, if Bauer goes and takes 1 year, 36.6942 from the Yankees or whoever, how does that impact other free agents? The Players Association can't be thrilled with a player taking a 1 year max AAV deal when that player, what would you project his contract to be? If Trevor Bauer weren't Trevor Bauer, if he were the same guy with those numbers at this stage of his career, if he didn't have his personality, just put a I'll do whatever I'm told personality in the Trevor Bauer robot, what contract does he sign?
Yeah, I mean, he's projected for about four wins, but the problem with using that sort of thing as gospel is that pitcher projections are always much worse than hitter projections. And, you know, he's kind of showing us what he could do in a given season, and that's going to get more, I think, than if you just took wins. Like, if you took wins and you were saying, like, a 5-year contract, you start him at 4, maybe give him 2 years of 4, that's 8. Then you start giving him 3.5 and 3 and 2.5, you know, like, maybe you can, like, give him 18 wins over 4 years. People are trying not to pay full freight, which would be $8 million or whatever. That's like $150 million. 5 years, $150 million.
Yeah.
$140 million.
It's not outlandish, because I think he's a more durable Zach Wheeler in terms of year-over-year expectations and track record. Mm-hmm. And Wheeler got 5 for 118 last winter.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know if he's actually going to go 5 years, or if he'd do 5 with the opt-out like I described. I really don't know.
I don't see how you push him above Cole. Maybe on the one-year thing is the only way. I don't see him, like, even if he did like a 3 year worth after with an opt out after 1 year, I don't think that anyone's given him like $155-160 million for 3 years with an opt out.
I mean, I know a lot of what he's about is betting on himself and doing things his own way. I get that. There are other people and other players that have varying degrees of doing that also. But at a certain point, it is foolish and it is damaging to other players if you compromise too much and really just buckle down for that 1 year. I know that's what he said he was going to do in the past, but times have changed, right? I mean, pre-pandemic, maybe betting on yourself year to year, okay, there's a little more uncertainty in the world now. Maybe this uncertainty was there all the time, but you realize the magnitude of the uncertainty after the year we've all just gone through.
Yeah, and it's just, like, who has the budgets? I wonder what his conversations are like. Who has the budgets? I know what some lower-level free agent conversations are like, and they're just saying we don't have budgets. That might be, you know, we have a budget for Bauer, but we don't know what we have beyond that or whatever. But still, like, I'm sorry, I did the math on 36.592 No, 36. I need to do this right. 36.69420 times get it three. Right. 110 million. Say, is that in the random possibility? 110 for three with an opt-out?
An opt-out after the second year? Because if you're going to make that commitment, you probably want to know you've got him for 2 years.
I think so, unless too. That's you what I'm saying. You want to know him for a little bit. Unless you intend to pitch him every 4 days. And
if you're going to pitch him every 4 days.
You don't want the opt-out. Then you want the 1 year.
Right. Do you think he's the kind of guy that would take a slightly customized contract? If he gets what he wants and pitches every fourth day and he breaks, then would he give like, the team an out?
Yeah, I mean, again, a thing that would, I could see that.
Piss off the Players Association.
Cancel the opt-out or something.
Right. Like you can terminate it. It becomes a team option if my arm blows up.
I could see that. I could see that. And I could also see him taking a 5 year, you know, $125 million contract and then just making a big deal about getting shot in the nuts and like making it a big, you know, watch momentum. Maybe we made too much of his requests. The team giving you the $100+ million usually gets a lot of say in how you're used and what happens after.
Yeah, I haven't received any nine-figure payments, but I imagine the person giving you a nine-figure payment dictates a lot of the terms of how things will go from that point forward.
Yeah.
That is seemingly how those sorts of arrangements work. Again, yeah. No firsthand experience for me. Getting away from Bauer and moving over to Masahiro Tanaka, I agree with what you said yesterday, kind of in passing. I don't see him in Boston. That would be weird. Seeing Tanaka pitching for the Red Sox. So it's not only that, it is their luxury tax issues. It is kind of where they are. I don't think they're hopeless by any stretch. I think they could put it back together relatively quickly. But I actually think Tanaka makes a lot of sense for a team like the Twins. I think he'd be a good fit in Minnesota. I think I trust that organization to help him continue to age gracefully. And, you know, I think relative to the expectations he had when he first came over and signed that, at the time, big deal with the Yankees, this is a little bit like a pitching equivalent of Jose Abreu, where it turned out pretty good, right? I mean, the Yankees got good return on that massive contract, and that was with Tanaka having a couple of injuries along the way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I think Tanaka makes sense for sort of win-now-ish teams that could use somebody that they want to like pencil in, you know. I think of like the Padres, like you've got all the young guys, but just like penciling in Tanaka feels like, okay, now we only need one or two of the young guys to really hit their marks rather than like two or three, you know. And so I like him on the Padres. The Angels just have to get a mention anytime a pitcher is mentioned. So, and I could see Tanaka going there. You know, LA has a vibrant community for Tanaka to join. It's a shorter trip to Japan. I think these things matter. He could say, okay, you know what, fine, I'll take 3-30 as opposed to the 3-45 we were looking for, because I get to go to LA or San Diego or Toronto, possibly. It's a pretty international city. I think people kind of don't realize that. So those are my teams for Tanaka. In terms of park, I think almost all of them represent a slight upgrade in terms of home runs allowed, which have been a big deal for him.
Right. As a right-handed pitcher, giving up the platoon advantage to lefties who mash at Yankee Stadium, it's easy for righties to hit there too. His biggest flaw is amplified by that park. So I just think his ratios could stabilize quite a bit with a move out of Yankee Stadium. I was going to ask you, over or under on a 4.26 ERA and a 1.26 WHIP for Masahiro Tanaka. I think a 4.26 ERA would be his third worst of his career, and a 1.26 WHIP would be the highest of his career if the steamer projections come true.
I'm really surprised to find that his homer rate away from home is virtually identical to his home rate at home. So that's not what I would have expected. There was a thing that Mitchell Lickman always said, is that MGL, he always said that park factors were kind of overrated and that flyball pitchers weren't necessarily going to give up more homers in certain parks than other parks, like homer parks. It's not something I ever really understood. But over under on the 4.26. Is that what you're saying? Over under on the 4.26. Over, but still credible pitcher.
over 426, under 126 though, because the whip is always pretty good.
Yeah, I would say like sort of a 4-4, 1-2-0 type, like a little bit like his 2019.
Yeah, he's got to get a lot of innings to make that work. So,
but if he goes to the National League and there's no DH,
and if he goes National League Marine layer, even better. Yeah,
I think so. I know what MGL said, but I'm just gonna say like. If the over-under on his home runs next year is 169, that's what he gave up this year, 169 per nine, I'm taking the under in almost any other park. So it'd be fascinating for me to sort of watch that happen.
This is only a partially developed thought, so this could unravel very quickly. But trying to understand what Mitchell Lichtman said, I'm wondering if the argument would be that you have just bad pitches that are home runs anywhere. Like, if that's part of the argument, that the type of home runs a guy like Tanaka gives up, there's no doubters, right? It's not like it's an extreme. It's kind of like we talk about pitchers who are good at avoiding hard contact. If you are a certain type of pitcher and your misses are more likely to be crushed, barreled, you'd have a problem with home runs regardless of ballpark. Again, a partially formed thought. Does that seem like that might sort of connect the dots a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. I just lost the. Here we go. Let me see what he got. Flyball pitchers were not at more of a risk than other pitchers when they ventured inside a hitter's park. It's just not something I understand. I think that part of it might be okay. One thing I can see when I look at his research, where he took pitchers and he grouped them into flyball pitchers and groundball pitchers and looked at them in hitters and pitchers parks. He's looking at overall runs scored. And I think that when we think about park factors, we often think about park factors as just home run park factors. But there are strikeout, walk park factors, there are singles, doubles, and triples. And there's some things that's as obvious as Coors, where they kind of moved the fences out for fewer homers and created more singles and doubles. So I could see that sort of machination means that the pitcher overall does about the same. So they give up a couple of homers when they would have given up doubles or triples. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so I was thinking about Great American Ballpark as a good visual. It's a park that boosts home runs, but because the outfield is so small, you're going to lose doubles and triples into the gaps, right? Those balls are going to be outs because the outfielders can cover a lot more ground for balls in play. So runs overall don't get boosted at all. And home runs get boosted because the fences are close and it's a small park.
Yeah. And then look at Sonny Gray's homer rate. You know, it wasn't the biggest part of why he was terrible in Yankee Stadium. He had larger home run rates with the Athletics, which supposedly is super. So I think it's about mistakes. Like, I think it's a little bit. I think there's more study to be done here, honestly. Because this is something that in the fantasy community we take for granted, that a flyball pitcher is going to go to a home run park and give up a bunch of homers. Sonny Gray just had the second best home run rate of his career in Cincinnati.
He's improved his home run rate every year since 2016.
Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, I don't know. There's not a lot of accounting for like velocity and stuff, and just splitting pitchers into ground ball, fly ball right now is interesting. This was done in 2012, and the league has changed a lot since then. I don't know if that makes it any less or more viable, but you know, just the definition of what makes a ground ball pitcher might have changed since then, because we have fewer and fewer ground ball pitchers. But maybe this sort of analysis was part of why teams started being like, hey, we can have flyball pitchers.
More work to be done, as you said. Still a lot to unearth. But if the field, if people in your league assume things to be true that are not true and you push back, you can gain leverage on the field. You can have opportunities to get players that are overlooked and undervalued because of fears that are unfounded. That's why this is important. That's why this sort of research is highly valued. Thinking about the Angels and hypotheticals and pitchers, if they were to miss on Bauer, like I think that's where you want him to go, or you think he's going to go, someone else swoops in, they get Bauer. The Angels need two starters. They could use the money they're going to give to Bauer and get two. They could get Tanaka, and they could get one more. And I wonder if Tomoyuki Sugano might be kind of part of their plan B. If the Bauer chip falls somewhere else, Tanaka plus Sugano could become an actual script the Angels could follow.
And with Ohtani in place, like it's cool, you know, like it has like a marketing aspect, you know. Imagine if that team wins a championship with three Japanese guys on, you know, as in like super prominent roles, and one of them is a DH/SP, you know, that I think that would be kind of one for the books. And then, you know, otherwise Sugano represents something like the median outcome for Sugano might be near Tanaka because their numbers in Japan were very similar, but that's just the median outcome. I think the range around that median outcome is higher for Sugano. So slightly more interesting to a team that would like to roll the dice and could handle him being a 4-5 starter for the chance that he's a 2 starter. I don't know. I think that does not actually represent the Yankees that well. I think the Yankees would like to have somebody foundational behind Cole. They have Davey Garcia and Jordan Montgomery and Clark Schmidt. They have some guys that could pop and be better than they expected to be. I think they want innings to not have to depend on Davey Garcia and Clark Schmidt, Jordan Montgomery. So, but like the Blue Jays, I think could use that sort of variance. And then the Angels would love it because they would have a chance of getting an ace out of it, really.
That's a good point. I do think the Blue Jays, I mean, they come up a lot in conversations, almost as a second option. They're going to do something to make that roster better. I know that's a captain obvious sort of statement, but I think it's going to be at least a significant second-tier free agent is going to end up in Toronto because they have a nice young core in place, and they're at the point, they have some money to spend, they have clear needs, and they have free agents available who actually address those needs. So it's sort of a game of connect the dots, like which ones are actually going to get there. But I think they could be in for maybe two. I think, you know, Liam Hendricks could be a guy that ends up in Toronto. I think they need bullpen help. They need someone to stabilize the back end and take some of the pressure off a lot of the young guys out there. I mean, Rafael Dolis was a nice story last year, but I don't think you want to expect him to run it back this year. I think Jordan Romano's name comes up a lot as a possible deep league source of saves for early drafts. But I think about that bullpen being one where it looks a lot better with a guy like Liam Hendricks serving as the primary ninth inning guy because it just moves everybody else down a seat.
Yeah, no. And, you know, I got yelled at in my piece because I didn't connect them with Springer or Real Muto and stuff. I just didn't understand it because, you know, we talked about this in the last episode. The Blue Jays are top three when it comes to the catcher position by Steamer projections. You know, and now looking at their outfield, this is an interesting thing. None of their three outfield spots is projected to be average or better. They're very close.
They're really right-handed in their outfield,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that too, yeah. So, I mean, I guess an outfield addition could make sense, but their needs right now are just so clearly in the pitching department. You know, if they add a major league average starting pitcher, they vault past two teams, four teams. You know, they become basically equal with the White Sox by Steamer projections. That's one major league average starting pitcher. And if they added a reliever of Hendricks type, they would do something similar because Hendricks is projected to be the best reliever in baseball next year. So, you know, I look at the needs. I think you could do, and then also people were talking about their salary and they're like, well, they used to run payrolls of 150. Well, that was a while back, and Rodgers made money when a lot of places didn't, so maybe they could lean in and go back to the 150, but I just wasn't assuming they'd go all the way back to the 150. I was assuming they'd kind of go back to around 120 or 110, which means they have about $30 million to spend. And if you have $30 million to spend, that sounds like that could be easily like Sugano, Hendricks, and Jock Peterson, call it a day.
That would solve some problems because you'd get left-handed power to mix into the corner outfield spots. You'd stabilize the rotation and get a big upgrade in the bullpen. Really ticks all the boxes. It's not splashy, but it's impactful.
You leapfrog a lot of teams. I think you would be up there with the Twins and Padres in the top five.
Which, if they weren't in the same division as the Yankees and Rays, would make you feel really good. But if you're a Jays fan, you'd still be excited because they'd have a puncher's chance in that division with those upgrades.
And to put it in terms of divisional situation, they're basically tied with the Rays right now. And of course, the Rays are going to, you know, make some moves. But if the Blue Jays made those three moves, they would put some air between themselves and the Rays. And put themselves as wild card favorites. And I know that doesn't sound exciting, but wild card favorites and wait for, you know, Yankees to implode somehow. I mean, what are you going to do? You can't stop trying just because the Yankees are in your division.
No, you can't. They're not realigning. They're going to be there for a long time. So find your way to do it. And I think their best path is with that core really in pre-arb status as a group. Eventually that core is going to get expensive and they're going to go through something that looks like maybe what the Cubs are going through right now, where the young core that got them back to the postseason, they're going to have to get paid. So reckon with that in 4 or 5 years. Don't worry about that right now. Push some chips in right now while you can, and you might kind of exceed expectations now.
And on our plan, you know, the Sugano, Hendricks, Peterson plan, you know, the Peterson money drops out after 1 year. I think Sugano, the contract projections is hilarious because there's a bunch of projections that have put him down to like 2 years and, you know, 30 million or something. I don't understand that. With the way the posting system works, the leverage you have over him, the situation you're in, I think it's more likely to be, I don't think it's going to be Maeda-esque because that was just a weird-ass contract, but I also don't think he's going to get the Tanaka money. So I was thinking more like 5 and 60, 5 and 70, you know, like good pitcher prices where you're happy if he pops into the 2-1, but you can't pay him to like a 1 or 2 in the major leagues because he hasn't pitched in the major leagues yet. You know, there's that risk. So, you know, but even then, I don't think it'll be a team crippling type of contract. It'd be, you know, maybe he's not as good as you thought, but then he's like a $10 million fourth starter or something. Not that big a deal, you know. And Hendricks, a reliever contracts, they're 3-year deals. You know, if it doesn't work out, you'll be out of it in no time.
I think that's a sweet spot for the Jays if they can't land one of the biggest free agents. And I'm in your camp. I don't think they're necessarily going to get one of the elite guys, but I think they're going to be active nonetheless.
One thing I do want to mention real quick. This is a weird idea. Trade for Nolan Arenado.
Let's make a Nolan Arenado trade. What would it take for you? Congratulations, you're the Rockies' new GM. It's the third time you've been hired as the Rockies' GM on this pod. What would you want from the Blue Jays to trade Nolan Arenado?
Well, the one thing the Blue Jays have is depth in the starting pitching prospect area. And I would, as the Rockies, I would always be looking for pitching. And since it's all like how much money you're taking on, right? But somebody like Simeon Woods Richardson could be the centerpiece for that. You know, he could be good, but I did have one source that said that when Toronto got them, what they heard was that they got him to flip him. So you could then build some depth around that. Julian Merriweather throws nearly 100, might be a reliever, might not. You know, Hatch has become interesting. Anthony Kay is not that interesting to me, but he could be interesting to the Rockies. You have to kind of figure out what the Rockies like too, but like a big pitching package plus maybe you know, just a lower hitting prospect that's far away. Boom. I don't think that Arenado headlines, you know, what he brings back is like, you know, a top 10 prospect in baseball. It's just too big a contract.
Right, but if the Jays are willing to take on all that money, then they can swing a deal and not give up any of the top guys in their system, not give up an Austin Martin, not give up Jordan Groshans, not give up Pearson, right?
Yeah.
Maybe Orelvis Martinez has to be included in that deal. I think he's
back end top 100 guy.
Really interesting young guy. I mean, 19 years old, long-term shortstop.
You'd be like, okay, we're cool with Bo Bichette for a while, and then, you know, we'll figure out where Austin Martin plays. And
would you try to get Alejandro Kirk in that deal too, knowing the Jays are fairly well set with Jansen and Reese McGuire?
Can I tell you something weird, man? Steamer projects Alejandro Kirk to be the best catcher in baseball next year.
Yeah, Steamer might have had a few hazies before working on that number.
It's amazing, dude. I love it. Sort by WOBA, Alejandro Kirk.
I just picture E.T. wobbling around drunk.
Anyway, I think the Kirk is super popular, and of course they would rather trade Danny Jansen or Reese McGuire, but they're just coming off a terrible season, so who knows?
I don't hate that from the Rockies' perspective. If it's Danny Jansen as like the third or fourth player. I mean, if the Jays want to go all in with Kirk instead.
There's a lot to bet on with Jansen.
You know? Jansen, I think, at the least, is going to be a competent defensive guy that holds his own at the plate, but there's some potential growth, and you put him in Colorado, and maybe you get a bit of a boost, of course. But Orelvis Martinez is the guy that I really want. If I'm in the GM chair or the AGM chair in Colorado, that's what I want.
And throw the names at it so that it's, you know, Danny Jansen and Orelvis Martinez and Julian Merriweather and one more pitcher. And you sound like, we got a package of five. They're all exciting. This guy throws 100. Woo! And nobody's like, what'd you get?
Don't get Pirates in this deal. Don't get Garrett Cole in the Arenado deal. But I think because of the contract, the money that you'd be unloading, ownership's going to be happy with you either way. And if you can hit on a couple of the guys, you get back in that bundle.
That's
the bundle might
five.
Make sense when you're dumping a contract.
Yeah, I think so.
At a minimum, you already saved money, and now you can go get something else later. And dumping a contract, Nolan Arenado's worth every dollar of that deal. Like, this isn't about that.
Thinking about how bad the Rockies are. I mean, it's amazing. If you look at the depth charts, they have a thing called totals where you can just look at all the teams on the depth charts. And the Rockies, they come in as the third worst team in baseball, but they have zeros or negatives at every offensive position except for the ones manned by Story and Arenado. They need everybody except for Story and Arenado.
Start over. Just start over. Take the cartridge out. Blow in the cartridge.
Fire Burdich.
You have to. I hate calling for stuff like that, but you got to move on. If you're the owner of the Colorado Rockies, Dick Monfort.
How can you be below replacement? And not even just like a little bit. They are more than a win below replacement at three spots, offensive spots.
It's crazy. The team that we pick on the most now that the Mets are beginning to straighten it all out, it is hands down the Colorado Rockies. sorry, Rockies fans, but based on Eno's chart from earlier, you know, there's not a lot of you out there, but you know, we're not picking on you. We think you deserve better. We think you deserve a more forward-thinking front office that puts an actually good team on the field, challenging as it might be in that environment. That is going to wrap things up for this episode of Rates and Barrels. You can hit us up via email, ratesandbarrels@theathletic.com. On Twitter, he's at Eno Saris. I am at Derek Van Riper. We are back with you on Friday.
Thanks for listening.